This is an ABC podcast.
Once upon a time, journalists were trusted to hold those in power to account.
Deep Throat urged Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein to follow the money.
But now trust in mainstream media is disappearing, paving the way for conspiracy.
Pizzagate is real.
The satanic temple of Jeffrey Epstein.
I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we dive deep into the stories and dispel the rumours. New episodes on ABC Listen every Tuesday and Thursday.
It was the ultimatum that wasn't. Donald Trump backing down from his 48-hour deadline for Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz and claiming progress towards a deal is being made. Oil prices plummeted, but questions remain, including how all of this energy market tumult is affecting China, which takes in the lion's share of Iran's oil exports. So is the US using the ongoing conflict as leverage against China? Or has China's investment in electrification set it up to weather just this sort of crisis? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm the ABC's chief business correspondent, Ian Verinder.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us. This is Taco Tuesday, as it will be perhaps forever known. Donald Trump gave this very clear ultimatum about when he wanted to see the Strait of Hormuz opened. And yet, just before that deadline was about to hit, he suddenly decided that actually Iran deserves some more time. What did you make of what's happened over the last 2 hours?
To be honest, I'm not surprised on the one hand, because, I mean, he's done this so many times before, you know, just backflipped on threats. But I was still stunned that it happened because, you know, we were talking obliteration of Iran's entire electrical system, all its power plants. And then within, you know, I think it was a 2-day ultimatum, and 12 hours before it's due to expire, he's backflipped. And of course, the Iranians have come out and said, "Well, negotiations? When did we do that?" And so there's no agreement on either side even about whether talks took place, let alone a deal being. What did you make of it?
I mean, I think what we saw yet again was Donald Trump claiming progress where the other side claims there's none. And in some ways, this is in keeping with what we've seen before. But I didn't think we would see such a blatant disregard for a deadline that he had given. But one of the interesting things here is that, as Donald Trump has made the point himself, that America doesn't even really use the Strait of Hormuz, that in fact, it's other countries that should be more interested. And one of the countries that is very reliant, usually, on the energy that's coming through this strait is China. So I'm interested in this interplay between these big rivals for international influence and whether or not there is something else at play here as far as the motivation of the different characters involved.
Yeah, I mean, sure. But before we get into that, I mean, America does rely on Middle Eastern oil. And I mean, America is now the world's biggest producer and exporter of oil and LNG as well. But it still needs oil from elsewhere because its oil is very light, low in sulfur. So you need to have a mixture of oils the refineries need that to create to produce the fuel they need. So only about 60% of the oil in American refineries is American oil. The rest of it comes from Canada, Mexico, and the Middle East, which leaves Donald Trump and America just as exposed to the situation is created as everybody else. But yeah, I think, you know, your point about geopolitical influences here, and particularly we're talking about China and Russia.
Well, let's break them down. Let's go with China first, because obviously it is the growing influence in the global economy. Donald Trump has delayed a long anticipated visit to China because of the situation in the Middle East. He had designs on hopefully striking some sort of new trade deal with them. There was talk of this being a very big, luxurious state visit that has now been delayed, and the relationship between America and China remains slightly confused. Are they looking to become better friends, or are they actually just trying to carve out their own empires and spheres of influence? How do you think potentially America's moves in the Middle East relates to that relationship.
Well, I think your second theory is the one that's probably more on the money. And I mean, this meeting was supposed to take place, I think, at the end of this week. Now it's been delayed by, we're not sure exactly, we don't have a date.
Maybe a month, maybe a bit longer.
I think they said 5 or 6 weeks or when the conflict in Iran ends. And that might be a bit of a clue as to how long the White House is thinking this is going to go on for. There's been a theory floated, and very early on in proceedings, actually, when the US and Israel started bombing Iran, that America and Donald Trump in particular was looking for some kind of, you know, upper hand in negotiations. And he's been forever upset, angry at the way China uses its muscle over rare earths. And basically, no more rare earths for you.
Rare earths are these kind of essentially ingredients that are used in a lot of the high-tech industries that we now rely on, including electric vehicles. But they're also, they go into computer chip manufacturing. There are a certain group of compounds that China has basically taken control of strategically, and most countries are reliant upon them.
China controls around 90 to 100%, depending on which rare earth you're talking about. And they're in everything from, you know, low-end, you know, electronics through to space equipment. And so America has been forever angry about the way China has basically taken control of this. And one theory was that Trump was trying to get the upper hand by saying, well, we don't like your rare earths policy, so here's an energy policy for you. We've got control of Venezuela's oil, which you were getting on the cheap because it was sanctioned oil. We've now taken control of Iran or Iran's oil processes, which you were getting on the cheap because it was sanctioned oil. So what do you think about that? But it hasn't quite worked out that way, has it?
Well, it hasn't worked out yet. I mean, even the Venezuela example is they literally took out the president of that country. And although the regime has stayed in place, it does appear that they're more malleable to American influence. The Iranian question, even though Iran seems to have effectively closed down that Strait of Hormuz, which is that very narrow, what we call choke point, where so much of the world's energy supply usually goes through, Iran has stopped it, but they've also kind of had to stop their own sending of oil out as well. There's been a few ships that seem to have been getting through with Iranian permission, but it has definitely slowed that flow. But you think this is all about America, or at least in part about America having more leverage over China?
I think that was the initial intention. I don't think it's worked out that way. Clearly not, because the repercussions that have, you know, flowed through to stock markets, through to bond markets, through to commodity markets, that is hurting America. Now, getting back to China, of course, taking out or putting your foot on Venezuela and Iranian oil, that accounts for around about 17% of China's oil imports. Now, Iran and China are tied at the hip, really, because Iran exports around about or more than 90% of its oil to China. So it's an absolutely vital market for Iran. It's one of the few places that will buy its oil because it's been sanctioned. And China has since had to up its oil purchases from Russia. Now, another interesting dynamic there in that America has lifted the sanctions on Russia, on Russian oil. And that means Russian oil is now at market, global market prices. All of these sanctioned oil producers, Venezuela, Iran, Russia, were selling their oil at $15 a barrel cheaper than the global market price. That really helped China. China's economy is not in great shape either, by the way. So to suddenly whack it with a huge increase in cost, I mean, the Chinese economy is overloaded with debt as well. So to suddenly hit it with a big cost increase for energy, that is going to hurt.
And again, to explain why it is that Russian oil is cheaper, Iranian oil is cheaper, when you've got a situation where the West is sanctioning it, you're effectively pulling them out of the market, aren't you? Yeah. You basically just have less buyers, and so therefore it's not as competitive to purchase that oil.
Well, it's a ban on those oils, on purchasing those resources. And the only countries that have been that are prepared to break those bans are countries like China. India has also broken those bans a couple of times as well. And they've only, just in the past few months, India has agreed to, you know, okay, we'll accept all the sanctions, we'll only buy from, you know, proper market sources. And now, of course, they've been allowed to buy Russian oil again because, you know, Donald Trump wants oil out there in the marketplace because it is hurting his constituents.
Let's talk about the condition of China, though, because on one hand, as you say, there are real pain points in that economy. They are loaded up with debt, particularly when it comes to the property market. You know, for a long time, people have spoken about these ghost cities, the overconstruction of major major cities, effectively, that were almost empty in some cases, and people just putting too much money, debt-fueled property boom, which has caused a huge amount of instability in their financial markets. But China has done seemingly a good job of electrification, moving aggressively into trying to electrify their national grid and also move to electric vehicles, which in theory should mean they're less reliant on oil, at least in the longer term. How do you think that's playing out at this point of geopolitical tension?
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right. I mean, they are the world's leading producer of electric vehicles. They are the world's leading producer of batteries. You know, they have just gone full on into electrification. But I think what this crisis has, you know, reminded us all of is that we are still very much hooked into the world of petrochemicals, fossil fuels. We can't really do without them. And, you know, while we're globally engaged in this, I guess, fight to try and, you know, jettison those fuels and switch to, you know, renewables, we're a long way from that. Even, you know, here in Australia, we talk about South Australia having, you know, its whole grid sort of hooked up to renewables. But on a national level, we cannot get away from coal at the moment. It's diminishing. And we're replacing coal, though, in many regards with gas to produce our electricity, even as renewables take over there. So we're a long way from being, you know, shaking off that addiction to fossil fuels.
But this once again does highlight, particularly for a country like China, which wants to be as self-reliant and not dependent on outside forces as it possibly can be. It highlights how important it is for them to try to both electrify and find domestic sources of energy, be they renewable or moving more into nuclear or whatever it might be. And surely this is going to spur that on.
I think globally this crisis, and this is shaping up to be the worst and possibly even worse than in the 1970s, this is going to accelerate the shift away from fossil fuels ultimately. You're probably going to see a lot of smaller countries, particularly in our region, you know, like you're looking at countries like Pakistan, Sri Lanka and so forth, that are going to probably, if not default on their debts, go through the same kind of problems that they experienced, you know, ever since the global financial crisis, because they will not be able to outbid other countries for supplies of fuel.
Yeah, and Australians at the moment are feeling the pain, and people don't like seeing how high prices have gone here. But relatively speaking, we're a rich country, and Australia has the ability, the leverage to be able to outbid many of these poorer countries to actually at least secure our fuel supplies. The chance of us as a country being cut off are pretty minimal, aren't they? But for some of these other countries, it gets pretty hairy pretty quickly.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, you'll accelerate the shift to renewables, but, you know, what are we going to use as a bargaining chip to bring in jet fuel and diesel and so forth? We're going to say, well, we're an exporter. We're one of the world's biggest exporters of LNG, another petrochemical, another fossil fuel. So if you cut off our supplies of liquid fuels, we'll have to think very hard, long and hard about whether we give you our LNG. So, you know, we are still hooked into that system, and it's going to take probably decades before we can throw it off. But this will probably be one of the major factors that really accelerates that shift away from fossil fuels.
Well, one of the other big players in the petrochemical world, of course, is Russia. We've been speaking about how America has now changed the rules, at least on some of the Russian petrochemicals floating around the world, pulled off some of the sanctions. There's talk of relaxing them even further. There was a question about what would be the Russian response to a strike on Iran. They've had a long-standing relationship. They haven't come to the, seemingly, at least in the open, come to the military aid of Iran. But what does this conflict do to them, and what does it do about the shift of balance between these big players?
Well, Russia is, you know, the great winner from this war. It's ever since Donald Trump decided to get rid of the sanctions on Russian oil and gas. It's brought in several billion dollars of extra income, which clearly has upset Ukraine and President Zelensky, who's just ropeable about it, because it's essentially funding Vladimir Putin's war against Ukraine. I mean, Russia is losing around about 30,000 troops a month in this long, grinding campaign. What it's now entering, it's four years going into five. It was supposed to be all over in a week. And this gives you a bit of an indication of the problems that America could run into in the Middle East, because, you know, Putin was absolutely convinced this was only going to last a week.
Wars are never predictable, are they? Even if it seems that one side has the firepower at their disposal and seems to have the economic might to do it.
But you think about this. What's in Russia's best interest now? It is for this conflict in the Middle East to continue, because Putin can continue selling Russian oil at global market prices. And there's been a long-standing tie-up in the production of drones between Iran and Russia. So if the Strait of Hormuz remains shut, Russian oil remains very, very lucrative for Russia to sell. And there's a potential there to supply drones as well.
So people keep talking about the metaphorical exit ramp for this war. And what is Donald Trump going to need in order to both claim victory in Iran, but also extricate himself before, as you say, this imposes too much of an economic cost in America and therefore hurts him at the upcoming midterm elections, which, again, Donald Trump is not up for re-election. He should be done two terms and you're done in America. The midterm election will be critical for him as far as his legacy is concerned and his own potential impeachment. And so it's a very critical election for him. This is the full House of Representatives.
Well, you spent a lot of time there. I mean,
yeah, this is crucial. And Donald Trump is obsessed with the midterm election result because he's concerned that if Democrats take control of the House of Representatives, that he could be impeached again. So he doesn't want Americans to be hurting when they come to cast their votes in November. But he also can't look like he's lost a war in the Middle East. That's also going to be damaging for him. So how does he claim victory but also get out? And how risky do you think this environment is?
Well, I think he just gets out and claims victory, really. But, I mean, there's no easy out to this. And if they land US troops on the ground, if they put Marines into ground operations there, that is, I mean, all you got to do is cast your mind back to George W. Bush standing on that aircraft carrier. Was it mission accomplished? That was just after the Iraq invasion. 13 years later, they were still there. And then when they finally did leave, ISIS took control of Iraq. So, you know, that gives you a bit of an indication of where this could all head.
He wouldn't be the first leader to go into a war that he thought would be easily won, only to be stuck there years later. And that's not time that he has up his sleeve.
It is.
One advantage Vladimir Putin has is he doesn't actually face competitive elections.
I mean, it is quite extraordinary, though. Did you think that they would go into this conflict and not think that the other side would fire back or to take control of the strait? It's 3.2 kilometres wide. It's not that hard to secure, especially with drone technology these days. What do they cost? $30,000 US, and you can stop an entire fleet of ships with them.
It has proven so far to be an impossible task for America to keep it open, despite Donald Trump continuing to claim it. And as you said, there is this question mark now about whether or not Marines could potentially be deployed. You would think that would be a very risky venture, but a lot of people didn't think they wouldn't kill the Ayatollah either in Iran. That was also a big step, wasn't it? So much to discuss. We could go all day, but I think we'll have to end it there. Thanks for joining us, Ian.
Thanks, Carrington.
And that's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. Two down, hopefully many more to go. Thank you to each and every one of you that's joined us already. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow, so you don't miss out. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen. Just search and follow the ABC Business Daily feed. And if you like what you're hearing, tell your friends. If there's business and economic news that has you stumped, we're here to help. You can send in a question, preferably a voice note, to ABC Business Daily at abc.net.au. And we'll endeavour to answer it in a future episode. Thank you, Ian.
And thank you, Carrington.